So let me just give you the opportunity. Just introduce yourself and how you like to be.
Okay. My name is Alicia Galvez. I'm a professor of Latin American and Latino studies at Lehman College of the City University of New York.
So, Alicia, you're an anthropologist, you're an immigration expert, and back in 2006, you decided that you wanted to do a study that was looking at immigrant women, mothers who were coming from Mexico to the United States. And you end up finding out that these are Mexican women who are traveling north, that they're poor, but when they get to the United States, they're actually in pretty good health.
Yes, this is something that we call the immigrant paradox or the Latina paradox, which is this idea that people who come to the United States, who oftentimes have lower socioeconomic status than the average person who was born here, often have better health outcomes. The longer they're here, the worse they tend to do, even though their incomes might rise and they may learn more English and become more incorporated into our institutions. That's actually associated, in fact, with a decline in health.
In her work in New York City, Alicia Galvez was seeing something many researchers have documented, this health paradox among immigrants to the United States. But our story is about what she started to see next in Mexico.
So I had the incredible good fortune of being able to visit the home communities of a lot of the women that I interviewed here in New York back in Mexico. They would describe their communities as being full of fresh fruit and vegetables and their families growing things from the land. And the incredible healthfulness of the lifestyle in those rural communities where someone eats the food that they've grown with their own hands. When I visited their families starting in 2008, I started to see a transformation in those rural communities. They wouldn't be growing their own food. They would no longer have access to the land or to the labor that the land requires. And so we started to see a decline in health, where the moms were then being diagnosed with diabetes, kidney disease, are no longer eating in the same ways. They might be purchasing more of their food rather than growing it. And I didn't really understand what was happening. I was struggling to understand how things were changing over time. And then I really realized it was NAFTA. If I have to pick one thing that can really be blamed for the decline in health, for the destruction of foodways in Mexico, it's the North American Free Trade Agreement.
From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today, can a free trade agreement with the United States be blamed for making Mexicans less healthy? Alicia Galvez says yes. She's the author of a new book called Eating NAFTA, Trade, Food Policies, and the Destruction of Mexico. The trade agreement between Mexico, the United States, and Canada went into effect in 1994, and it accelerated huge changes in the Mexican economy.
Because of NAFTA, Mexico sort of became a lab in which to study the health effects of trade policy.
In her book, Alicia goes way back. She traces trade policy in North America long before NAFTA, and she digs into the effects after NAFTA was passed. She documents drastic changes in how Mexicans eat and how those changes have amplified a health crisis. In Mexico, the rates of obesity have gone up precipitously over the last 30 years, and type 2 diabetes has become the number one killer in the nation. Since 2008, Alicia has taken over 15 trips to Mexico and has conducted formal interviews with nearly 50 subjects.
I was surprised to find that people who had migrated, who left family members in strong health, returned and no longer were their communities associated with that healthy lifestyle.
So one of the stories that you tell in your book is the story of Angelo Cabrera. He leaves his small town in Mexico. He's gone for 24 years. When he leaves, his family is healthy. His mom is healthy.
Mm-hmm. You know, I still remember my mom was a very healthy woman.
He comes back to Mexico from the United States, and he sees his mom. Mm-hmm. and suddenly she's not so healthy.
No, sadly, his mother had become blind due to complications from diabetes.
It was heartbreaking for me.
Alicia shared this recording of Angelo with us. He says that his mom had to touch his face in order to recognize him. He wasn't used to his mom in this state, and when he saw her pick up a knife to start to prepare his dinner, he ran over to her and snatched it from her hands.
And she started crying because I told her, no, you're not going to cut the peppers with the knife. You're not going to cut anything. You're not going to use the knife at all. And then my dad took me out of the kitchen and he just told me, like, let her cook.
Angelo Cabrera's mother is just one data point in what is really a vast health crisis. So what can the health problems of just one Mexican woman actually tell us about NAFTA? In order to answer that question, we've got to go back in time. So let's talk about Mexican eating before NAFTA. So what was, generalizing Mexican cuisine pre-NAFTA?
So this is what sometimes people call the three sisters kind of agriculture, which is the intercropping in a single plot of land. You grow your corn, your squash, and your frijoles, your beans, on the same plot of land. And if you think about how these things grow, the corn is a stalk, the frijoles and the squash are vines. And so the vines help to hold up the stalk. The stalk provides the support for the vines. The nutrients, the micronutrients in the soil are replenished by this kind of intercropping. And so if we think about that corn-based diet, right, and there's sort of a joke in, you know, in Mexico when people talk about, well, what's a tlacoyo? Well, you start with the corn masa, and then you add the sauce and the meat and the protein or the cheese or the vegetables. And what's a taco? Well, you start with the corn masa. And what's a tamal? You start with the corn masa, right? Everything starts with the corn masa. But this is the foundational nutrient.
This way of eating was the foundation of healthy living for many Mexicans, good for the body and good for the soil. And this way of farming was protected by the Mexican government. Those protections were achieved a century ago during the Mexican Revolution.
The revolution was fought to give access to land to rural people, to make the prosperity and the wealth of Mexico more equitably shared.
In 1917, as a result of the revolution, Mexico ratified a new constitution. And the constitution included a very important article, Article 27.
Article 27 is the mechanism, it's the part of the Constitution that guarantees access to land. It guarantees the right to land for those who work it. It enables indigenous communities to communally share land. They can't sell it, they can't partition it. They're able to work it and live off the fruits of the land in a communal way.
Alicia says Article 27 made it possible for farmers, even poor ones, to continue to live a healthy life. And that went on for decades until the 1990s, which is when the Mexican government was in the middle of negotiating NAFTA, and it fundamentally changed Article 27. Mexico got rid of those protections for small farmers because they were seen as an obstacle to a truly free and open market.
The suspension of Article 27 enabled communally held lands to be sold and to be consolidated into private farms. And this enabled massive corporations to come in and swoop in and get lots of land that had previously been used for small-scale farming. The government also withdrew its system that enabled farmers to get their crops to market and to provide price supports.
I'd also like to welcome here the representatives from Mexico and Canada and tell them they are, in fact, welcome here. They are our partners in the future that we are trying to make together.
In late 1993, President Bill Clinton celebrated the opening up of the Mexican market for U.S. goods.
No country should use cartels, subsidies, or rules of entry to keep our products off its shelves.
Coming up, NAFTA becomes the law of the land. Stay with us, no te vayas.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Babbel. Have you always wanted to speak a new language? Whether it's for travel, work, or brain training, Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons will get you speaking confidently in your new language. Choose from Spanish, French, and more. You'll learn through real-life dialogues, speech recognition, and interactive trainers. And Babbel's spaced repetition method actually makes you remember what you've learned. Download the app or go to Babbel, Babbel.com, to try Babbel for free. Support also comes from BetterHelp. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who specialize in issues such as depression, stress, anxiety, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment at your convenience. Get help at your own time and your own pace. Schedule secure video or phone sessions. Plus, chat and text with your therapist. Visit BetterHelp.com/NPR to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
Every day, on her way to and from work, Laura Bates, like millions of women around the world, suffered indignities, big and small.
It just made me sit down and ask myself, why is this normal?
She launched a website called Everyday Sexism, and thousands of women, and even some men, started to share their stories too. Ideas around gender and power on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
We're back. And we're continuing with our story about NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. On January 1st, 1994, NAFTA goes into effect. And it brings big changes to Mexico, from the smallest store shelves to the largest industries.
NAFTA is a massive trade agreement that covers everything from auto parts and computer parts to intellectual property to trade dispute arbitration, to pricing of commodities. It covers so many different factors. NAFTA is premised, it's based on a simple concept, which is that economies should be linked and that there should be a free flow of capital and goods between economies. Unfettered, unrestricted capitalism. So I think if we had to pick one food item that is the most illustrative, that kind of tells the story of NAFTA, I think we would have to look at corn. Initially, the farmers might be growing corn still, but unable to get it anywhere, right? So we see that farmer no longer having that access to market, right? Because the Mexican government had to undo a lot of the supports that it had for its farmers. The farmer might grow beautiful corn. I had a farmer tell me, I grew beautiful corn, but I had to feed it to the pigs because there was nowhere to sell it.
Small farmers couldn't compete with the new industrial farms and with U.S. corn distributors that now had easy access to the Mexican market. So as a result, researchers have estimated that NAFTA forced 2 million Mexican farmers out of work in the 1990s and 2000s. Without income from farming, many Mexicans immigrated to the United States. And for the others who stayed, their lifestyles changed. Many took new jobs in manufacturing, which means they had less time to cook or eat at home. And they often did their eating on the run. Lucky for them, supermarkets selling cheap processed foods were now flooding into Mexico.
Little by little, we start to see this expansion of the global corporate network in terms of distribution of processed foods.
In 1991, there was one Walmart, and by 2012, Walmart is now Mexico's largest retailer. 2,000 locations. I mean, these are kind of extraordinary numbers.
Yeah, so Walmart, the soda distribution networks.
Sprite tiene algo que decirte.
When you see the Coca-Cola truck being the first vehicle to go down a road that was just paved.
Entonces, vas a disfrutar Coca-Cola Life, hecha con endulzantes naturales.
Within NAFTA, it's now cheap and easy to distribute everywhere, even in the most remote communities.
But the food that Coca-Cola truck is distributing is not the most healthy.
One story that really helps illustrate this is the story of my friend Yolanda, who lives in a very small town outside of Tehuacan, San Antonio, Texcala. She has a little tienda, a little store in the front room of her house, what we might think of in New York City as a bodega or a corner store. Yolanda told me that she would have liked to have stocked fresh fruit, that she would like to stock things that she prepares herself. But there's no distribution system. The Coca-Cola truck will bring her Coca-Cola products, including all of the snack cakes and everything else, to her doorstep without her lifting a finger. They provide her with her shelving, they provide her with refrigerators, with signage, and they restock her whenever she needs it. But if she wants to sell a piece of fruit, she has to take the public bus to Walmart and at retail purchase the fruit or whatever fresh product she wants to sell in her store. And by the time she does that, she's an elderly woman. Fruit is heavy. She takes it on the bus. It's expensive. She gets it back. Her neighbors say, no, that's too pricey. I don't need to buy fruit from you. And so she has no ability to really sell fresh fruit products. And if you walk into her store, virtually everything that you see will be things that are packaged, that are shelf stable.
It's no wonder then that Mexicans eat a lot more processed foods now than they did in the past. As just one example, Mexico has become one of the world's top consumers of instant noodles.
De la minestrone. Presentamos Maruchan Trone Ramen. Esto es hashtag Maruchan Ramen con Mariano.
Instant noodles, you know, maybe they're tasty if you're a college student, but in many ways, these are adaptations to a lack of time, to a lack of resources.
Now, there are arguments that the increase of processed and packaged foods, the modern Mexican relationship with food in general, is actually a good thing.
Well, there's actually an interesting feminist argument that gets made. This idea that if women are going to be in the workplace, if women are going to be entrepreneurs, that they can't be at the stove hand grinding corn and making tortillas. Modern conveniences, prepared and processed foods, in many ways liberate women who've done the majority of the domestic labor. You know, the last thing we want to do is say, you know, if women want their families to be healthy, they should stop working and go back to the kitchen. Nevertheless, I think we have to be attentive to the trade-offs. And so there is a way that these ideas about freedom get taken up by the corporations and get marketed to us so that we're supposed to see as freedom not only women getting out of the kitchen and into the workforce, but see as freedom having, you know, cheap, affordable soda and cheap, affordable processed foods.
There is a tension here between blaming the health problems of Mexicans on their personal choices, like what they have for lunch, or on a big multinational system. But as Alicia argues, you can't separate those two things.
There are a lot of people in Mexico who say, you know, Mexicans have a big sweet tooth. I've had government officials look me in the eye and tell me it's the Mexican sweet tooth that can explain the really precipitous rise in diabetes and obesity. And it's this kind of blaming of the individual, blaming of the victims, actually, the people who are suffering the consequences of this incredible invasion of processed foods and transformation of the landscape. And so we see public policies being designed to address the diabetes and obesity epidemic that never once mention the transformed food landscape.
The Mexican government has declared diabetes a national health emergency, and it's imposed a tax on soda while it's trying to improve both prevention and medical care. It's also trying things like this. Super Zumba classes. Or, if you can't make it to class, there are 15-minute Move It sessions you could do during your breaks at work.
There's an ideology, there's an understanding of the onset of disease that basically places it as a problem of personal behavior. And at no point, by the way, do I kind of, I think, you know, make a causal argument that NAFTA causes diabetes. But what I am trying to point out is that all of these things are happening in the same time frame, and the explanations that we're being handed are not satisfactory.
There are also Mexicans who say that NAFTA has actually made Mexicans healthier.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say to that?
So there's an idea that is quite commonly held among those who see NAFTA as being, you know, a really wonderful shift for the Mexican economy. There are those who basically say that diabetes and obesity are diseases of prosperity, and that if a policymaker needs to, you know, assess the difference between diseases of prosperity and diseases of poverty, that who wouldn't want to die of a disease of prosperity? Right.
So better to die of diabetes, because that means that you've had a lot to eat and a lot of sweet stuff, than to die feeling hungry and in poverty.
Right.
Throughout the campaign, I promised to renegotiate NAFTA, and today we have kept that promise.
The U.S., Mexico, and Canada are now in the process of establishing a new trade agreement.
With an incredible new U.S. Mexico-Canada agreement called USMCA. It sort of just works, MCA.
But all of these public health issues that we've been talking about, they're not a main concern in the negotiations between the trade representatives. Still, Alicia Galvez wants people to understand how something as complicated and as huge as NAFTA can affect individual people's lives.
People don't think this has anything to do with them. And they think that it's such an obscure, you know, kind of trade deal that's very wonky and difficult to understand how it kind of relates to our lives. And so I think this is one way to get at it, you know, that it's kind of on our plates and it's in our bodies.
Alicia, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you.
Alicia Galvez is a professor at the Department of Latin American and Latino Studies at Lehman College of the City University of New York. She's the author of the book Eating NAFTA, Trade, Food Policies, and the Destruction of Mexico, which is currently available in bookstores nationwide. This episode was produced by Antonia Cerejido and edited by Allison McAdam. Special thanks to David Schwitte for letting us use audio from the documentary Salud, Myths and Realities of Mexican Immigrant Health. Our Latino USA team includes Miguel Macias, Maggie Freeling, Janice Yamoka, and Sayer Quevedo. We're edited by Marlon Bishop and Sofia Paliza Carr. Fact-checking by Nidia Bautista. Our engineers are Stephanie LeBeau and Julia Caruso. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholtz. Our interns are Caroline Aguirre and Lucas Southard. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. And if you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. And one more thing, dear listener to our podcast, we really love reading all of the comments that you leave us. So take a moment to go to your favorite podcast app and rate and review Latino USA. We love to read your comments, and also it helps other people to find us. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. Hasta la próxima. Ciao.
Funding for Latino USA's coverage of A Culture of Health is made possible in part by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. The New York Women's Foundation, funding women leaders that build solutions in their communities and celebrating 30 years of radical generosity. And Heising Simons Foundation, unlocking knowledge, opportunity, and possibilities. More at hsfoundation.org.
Okay. Yeah. I'm a boxer. Okay. Just keep that. Used to be a Zumba. No, I do Zumba. I love Zumba. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And next time on Latino USA, a conversation with first-time Grammy-nominated ranchera royalty, Ángela Aguilar. That's next time on Latino USA.